Hello and welcome to this episode of the Beyond podcast and this live recording of the opening of our Game at Chess Day from the 400th anniversary of the staging of this infamous play by Thomas Middleton. So we recorded this at the start of a very long day where there was a performance of A Game at Chess as well as this introduction, two panel discussions and a performance of Middleton's last work, the 1626 Lord Mayor's Show. On this 401st anniversary of the event, I am trying to release the recordings into the wild, and that will happen in a staggered way over the rest of the year. But if you can't wait that long, rough cuts of the whole day and the materials we use to make it are available as a box set on our Patreon for a one-off fee. Link in the show description. And remember, that's all timed for August 2025, so if you're listening to this in the deep future, you might not need to go to that link at all. It might already be on the podcast. But if you're listening to this live in August, the 401st anniversary of the event, then that is a thing. So, this is part one, the opening of the event, Middleton's Endgame. And the episode is called Setting Up the Board, where we set up the context for the play. In a little while, I will release a rough live mix of the performance of the play which followed this, and the following panels, etc. And I hope to do a fuller mix of the show with some more fairy dust thrown over it in time for Christmas. Which Christmas? I will not say. Till then, let me throw you back to Sunday the 11th of August 2024, one of the 400th anniversaries for A Game at Chess by Thomas Middleton, and I start the recording with some of the warm-up before setting up the board proper gets going. Enjoy. Hello and welcome to the next 7 hours of your life. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, and you are very welcome, most welcome. Make yourselves at home. Please note we're about to enter the early modern period. If you haven't already, do have a look at our content warnings appended on the wall outside the door or online. There are quite a few. Also, just a general note, following what I've said about quiet entrances and exits, as you may have noticed, this is a podcast. The room is wired for sound. And it will be for the next 7 hours on and off. So if you wish to confess to that murder you committed in 1973, now is not the time to do it.
Or maybe it is.
So yes, generally, do react obviously as an audience, but just do be aware that you are being recorded. I've covered all the basic housekeeping, got that out of the way, so we will now officially begin.
The Beyond Podcast presents Setting Up the Board, an introduction to the 1620s, the Spanish Match, and the creation of A Game at Chess by Thomas Middleton.
That was Liza Graham. I am Robert Crichton, and we are your hosts for this live episode of the podcast.
Please welcome the readers for Setting Up the Board: Gillian Horgan, Simon Nader, Daniel Yabut, Sojourner Hazelwood Connell, Kit McGuire, Valentina Vinci, Keith Hill, Connor Robert Brown.
Let me tell you a story. It's all about spies. Well, that's how John le Carré put it. And in a sense, that's what A Game at Chess is all about. Undercover agents undermining the state, projecting their suspect ideology onto the good and innocent, hard-working people of our nation, etc., etc.
But how do we set up for you, dear listener, A Game at Chess by Thomas Middleton? What information do you really need? And what information do you think you need? If you read any article about the play, then the first thing is always to say, the Spanish Match, which is something we will be looking at.
But before we begin, I really want to impress upon you,
and in my arrogance, impose what I think a game at chess is about.
It's about a chess game. A game at chess, if you will.
And on one level, that's actually about it. Yes, it helps if you know that the two halves of the chessboard are competing kingdoms from different confessions, Catholic versus Protestant, and maybe you need to know a little bit about the enmity between Spain and England, the Spanish Armada of 1588, the long history of shifting doctrine. But you don't necessarily need to know a damned thing about the Spanish match to understand the plot. Because the plot has no interest in a dynastic marriage between England and Spain to knit those nations together, which is basically all the Spanish match was. So yes, there are references and in-jokes, but basically...
chess match. The pieces don't want to get taken by the other side. Don't get put in the bag.
All that said, we are going to dip into the world around the play because A Game at Chess was a massive scandal and it's really interesting and who doesn't want a bit of history? There are a number of real people who Middleton will reference or caricature during the play. Who are the key pieces Middleton places on the board?
Well, I suppose the earliest in terms of history and where he appears in the play is...
Ignatius Loyola, born 1491, founder of the Jesuits, dies in 1556, and the laments of his ghost open the play.
Maybe we should mention Elizabeth I, whose attempts at a settlement between Protestantism and Catholic forces crumble over the length of her reign, and establishes the fundamental clash that the play world inherits. Her inheritor was,
James
of course...
James VI of Scotland, born 19th of June, 1566, later to be King of England. He appears as the White King in the play.
Someone who spent a lot of time trying to influence King James was Diego Sarmiento de Acuña, Count of Gondomar, born 1st November, 1567. He will feature in the play as the Black Knight. A couple of years before A Game at Chess... he stepped down as the Spanish ambassador, having tried to push a dynastic match between Spain and England-Scotland.
Gondomar was known primarily for one thing, as this libel about him shows.
Gondomar, anagram Romaine dog. This dog can bark and bite rather than fail, yet once he won dog's trick to wag his tail.
Sorry, why can't Gondomar wag his tail?
Because he had an incredibly famous anal fistula.
Why? What means this? England and Spain alike diseased? Or doth time both equal strike with fistulas? No difference is disclosed. Spain sets a fair face on't and England's nosed.
Mark well Gondomar's public-facing anal fistula. Not only famous for its existence, but also for his special chair of ease.
Aren't we above laughing at a man's anus?
Honestly? I don't think we are. And while we're on the problematic depictions of bodies, we should introduce who the play calls the fat bishop.
Marco Antonio de Dominis. Born 1560, he was a Catholic bishop who changed confession and came over to England in 1616.
Welcomed by King James, who gave him a whole raft of privileges, including property in the Savoy.
The bishop wrote a host of pamphlets attacking his former Catholic faith, but he was generally an unpopular figure in England. More on him later.
Sorry, aren't we forgetting someone?
Oh, yes, I almost forgot. The playwright. He gets born at some point.
Thomas Middleton, baptised on the 18th of April, 1580.
Now, when Middleton was eight in 1588, the Spanish Armada crisis becomes totemic in the English consciousness against Spain. Now, who else do we have on our board?
George Villiers, later Duke of Buckingham, was born 1592. He will appear on stage...
as the White Duke.
And Charles Stuart, son to King James, was born in 1600. He will appear on stage as the White Knight.
In 1603, King James comes to the English throne following the death of Elizabeth. He makes peace with Spain the following year. This peace will last approximately 20 years.
And coincidentally, around 1603-4, we first see Thomas Middleton writing plays with The Phoenix for the Children of Paul's. In the following decade and a half, Middleton will produce a prodigious flow of words for the page and the stage, singly and in collaboration. Michaelmas Term, A Trick to Catch the Old One, A Mad World, My Masters, A Yorkshire Tragedy, The Revenger's Tragedy, Your Five Gallons, The Roaring Girl, No Wit Like a Woman's, No Help Like a Woman's, A Chase Made in Chief.
We've only got 7 hours. A lot of words under the bridge. From city comedy to tragedies to tragicomedies to lots of things. But we're going to have to leap forward a bit. It's the 1620s, and there's a lot of vox about. Or rather, a lot of people writing pamphlets prefixed vox, starting with Thomas Scott's Vox Populi, and followed by a fair amount of similar stuff. And there just isn't time to cover all that here. But these invectives are largely all responses to the idea of marrying Prince Charles to the Infanta of Spain.
The Infanta is in theory represented in the play by the Black Queen. But because no one in the audience has seen her in real life, she isn't given much to do and isn't really connected with the plot at all. I'm not bitter.
This dynastic match is a policy pushed by the Spanish ambassador at the time, Gondomar of the world-famous Fistula, or a black knight, towards James I, our white king, and loudly hated by figures up and down the country. Here's a later bit of invective from a later vox on the Spanish match.
About some 3 years since, when our king was so earnest in proposing the match of our noble prince's son with the Infanta of Spain, when the king of Spain colourably pretended, though not really intended, to be deeply affected to entertain and embrace the said motion, when Count Gondomar, his ambassador, made sure to be a zealous solicitor and a most active and officious stickler for compassing and finishing it, when our Romish Catholics became passionately and insultingly confident of the free toleration of their religion, and in the sky-reaching mountains of their ambitious and superstitious hopes, were already preparing to erect their groves and altars, to set up their idols and images, and consequently to introduce their Pope and his Mass in the temples of our God, when all prisons were unlocked and open to all pernicious priests and dangerous Jesuits, and that many others like caterpillars and vipers came flocking and swarming from diverse parts of Europe to poison and eat out the souls of our people with their idolatrous doctrine of Antichrist, and to withdraw their hearts and consciences from their allegiance and fidelity to their natural prince and country, purposely, with more treachery than religion, to subject them to a foreign power and jurisdiction.
I think you get the picture. This kind of invective didn't go away, did it? And it's into this political world where Thomas Middleton is, as an established writer for the theatrical world of the 1620s. He's writing a host of entertainments for civic occasions, as from Wednesday, the 6th of September, 1620, he becomes the city chronologer. He's writing for official dinners, for civic centres, archery butts, and for that most important of events, the inspection of local plumbing infrastructure. Can I get an ooh? Ooh. You're easily pleased. It's the 18th of September, 1620, and dignitaries are gathering.
Upon the renewing of that worthy and laudable custom of visiting the springs and conduit heads for the sweetness and health of the city, a visitation long discontinued.
A water nymph seeming to rise out of the ground. Rise out of the ground by the conduit head near the banqueting house, thus greets the honourable assembly.
Let me clear my eyes. Methinks I see a comfort's approach, as if they came to me. I'm not used to it. I have been long without. How comes the virtue of the times about? Has ancient customs, yet a friend of weight. So many rare. Goodness, is weight to late out of her long sleep, sure, that was lain still many a dear day, charmed with neglect and will. I thought I'd been forsaken, quite forsook, for none these 7 years has bestowed a look upon my watery habitation here. I mean of power that ought to see me clear, for yon fair city's health, which sweetness bless and virtue in full strength ever possess. Well, fair thy visitation, noble lord, and this most grave assembly that accord in many ways of charity and care with thee, joys visit you as your loves visit me.
Well, it's a living, I suppose. We've all done worse gigs. And there are a host of other speeches and shows that Middleton was writing in 1620 into 1621, though he doesn't write the Lord Mayor's show for 1620. Maybe they were avoiding a charge of favouritism.
We should mention at this point that in 1621, there's a new King of Spain.
King Philip IV, a young monarch. He will vaguely appear as the Black King in the play. He says some lines. Not many.
Join the club.
We're not bitter.
Back to Middleton, who has not forgotten playhouses, for somewhere around here he writes Women Beware Women, which features a rather chunky scene involving chess.
Whew! 'Tis a great while till supper time. I'll take my leave then now, madam, and come again in the evening, since your ladyship will have it so.
In the evening? By my troth, wench, I'll keep you while I have you. Come, will to chess? Or draughts? There are 100 tricks to drive out time till supper. Never fear, wench. Would you deny such request, in faith? Speak truth and freely.
I were then uncivil, madam.
Go to, then. Set your men. We'll have whole nights of mirth together ere we be much older. Wench, come, widow, here's our business. Are we not well employed, think you?
Oh, when you spoke, there came a paltry rook full in my way and chokes up all my game.
Alas, poor widow, I shall be too hard for thee.
Well, you're cunning at the game, I'll be sworn, madam.
The Black King's mine.
Oh, cry you mercy, madam!
And this, my queen.
I see it now.
Here's a duke will strike a sure stroke for the game anon.
I know that, madam.
I give you check and mate to your white king. Simplicity itself. Your Spanish king there.
Well, ere now, lady, I have seen the fall of subtlety. Jest on.
Did not I say my duke would fetch you over, widow?
I think you spoke in earnest when you said it, madam.
And my Black King makes all the haste he can.
Well, madam, we may meet with him in time yet.
I have given thee blind mate twice.
You may see, madam, my eyes begin to fail.
I swear they do, wench. The game's e'en at the best now. You may see, widow, how all things draw to an end.
And so do I, madam.
What else is in the air in popular culture? Problematic depictions of gypsies in masks, in plays. They're suddenly everywhere, including in a play by Middleton, more dissemblers besides women. Here's a moment where a character enters disguised as a gypsy, having used the disguise to escape her captor. And the disguise and the racialized nature of the disguise might be important later.
I'm happily escaped. Not one pursues me. This shape's too cunning for him. All the sport was the porter would needs know his fortune of me as I passed by him. 'Twas such a plunge to me, I knew not how to bear myself. At last, I did resolve of somewhat. Looked in's hand, then shook my head, bade him make much on's eyes he would lose his sight clean long before he dies. And so away went I. He lost the sight of me quickly. I told him his fortune truer for nothing than some of my complexion that would have cozened him of his money.
Middleton's back in the civic pageantry mode, writing The Sun in Aries, the Lord Mayor's show for October 1621.
What noise is this? Wakes me from ruin's womb. Huh? Bless me. Time, how brave am I become? Fame fixed upon my head? Beneath me, round, the figures of illustrious princes crowned, as well for goodness as for state by birth, which makes them true heirs both to heaven and earth. Just six in number and all blessed names. Two Henrys, Edward, Mary, Eliza, James, that joy of honest hearts. And there behold, his honored substitute, whom worth makes bold to undergo the weight of this degree.
Somewhere around now, Middleton's also working on Anything for a Quiet Life with probably John Webster. And in 1622, he's also writing with William Rowley a little known play called The Changeling, which features issues of control, power, and barely in check desires.
Here's a favour. Come with a mischief. Now, I know she had rather wear my pelt tanned in a pair of dancing pumps than I should thrust my fingers in her sockets here. I know she hates me, yet cannot choose but love her on the matter. If but to vex her, I'll haunt her still, though I get nothing else. I'll have my will.
And why does this collaboration matter? Because Rowley, a major clown, will be added into the schema for A Game at Chess fairly late in the writing process. The character of the Fat Bishop is constructed for Middleton's occasional writing partner.
And while we're on the subject of the bishop, it's around now, 1622, that the real bishop, worried about his position if a Spanish match occurs, casts about for a return to Rome.
Thomas Middleton, meanwhile, might be contributing to the play The Nice Valour, but he definitely writes A Lord Mayor's Show in 1622, The Triumphs of Honour and Virtue, which features depictions of race and commerce, which we might unpack in another forum.
Ooh. At the same time, tensions with Spain are really starting to leak into popular culture, with plays like The Spanish Curate, The Noble Spanish Soldier, and The Spanish Gypsy, the last of which Middleton contributes to, and which frequently involves the painting of skin. We're into 1623, where plays frequently involve Spaniards, or bronzed actors, in roles that are at best quite dubious, and a nation increasingly urging for war. And into the middle of this, we have the ongoing attempt to match Prince Charles with the Spanish Infanta.
This has been going on so long that Charles and Buckingham decide to go to Spain in disguise to woo the Spanish Infanta, who might vaguely feature in chess as the Black Queen. Kinda. I'm not bitter. Give me more lines!
Charles and Buckingham totally fail with the woo. There is no woo. There is barely an ooh. And they return home the Spanish match dead.
Much to the jubilation of the English. Bonfires are lit at their return, songs are sung, alcohol is drunk, which can be heard in this ditty of the time. The tune is sadly lost, and so it will be spoken, and is known as Of the Prince's Return from Spain.
The prince is now come out of Spain. God bless his highness and his train. They all have seen Madrid. Yet most of them came post before, and happy he got first ashore to tell us how we did. They told us 20,000 lies to feed the people's fantasies and put them in great fear. But when the prince to England came and brought not home the Spanish dame, the papists hung their ears. They say the Pope cannot dispense, nor will he soil his innocence to match these two together. But had we known as much before, the cunning of old Gundamore could not have got him thither. Some say their victuals were but scant, but that's a lie, there was no want. The prince and duke had gifts, and so had everyone beside that could but either run or ride, the rest made other shifts. But when to London once he came to see the city on a flame, the people did admire. I speak it to the townsmen's praise. It's thought that since Queen Mary's days there was not such a fire. He was received with as much joy as was the wandering Prince of Troy when he to Carthage went.
With James's power and health waning, Charles and Buckingham push for war with Spain. James, who spent his life trying to be the peacemaker, resists, but anti-Spanish feeling is high. Amidst these bonfires, Middleton writes another Lord Mayor's show, The Triumphs of Integrity, with a speech which, amidst the other general notes of Isn't the New Lord Mayor Great, is perhaps hinting at a more pro-Charles future. The triumph features personified graces and is addressed to the new Lord Mayor.
The blessedness, peace, honour and renown this kingdom does enjoy under the crown, worn by that royal peacemaker, our king, so oft preserved from dangers menacing, makes this arms, glorious in itself, outgo all that antiquity could ever show. And thy fraternity strived to peer in all their course worthy the arms they bear. Thrice have they crowned their goodness this one day, with love, with care, with cost, by which they may by their deserts most justly these arms claim, got once by worth, now trebly held by fame. Shall I bring honour to a larger field, and show what royal business these arms yield? First, the three crowns affords a divine scope, set for the graces, charity, faith, and hope, which three the only safe combiners be of kingdoms, crowns, and every company. Likewise, with just propriety, they may stand, for those three kingdoms swayed by the meek hand of blessed James, England, Scotland, Ireland. The cloud that swells beneath them may imply some envious mist cast forth by heresy, which through his happy reign the heavens blessed will the sunbeams of the gospel strike through still. More to assure it to succeeding men, we have the crown of Britain's hope again, illustrious Charles, our prince, which all will say adds the chief joy and honour to this day. And as three crowns, three fruits of brotherhood, by which all love's worth may be understood, so threefold honour makes the royal suit in the king, prince, and the king's substitute. By the eight beatitudes, ye understand the fullness of all blessings to this land, more chiefly to this city, whose safe peace good angels guard and good men's prayers increase. May all succeeding honoured brothers be with as much love brought home as thine brings thee.
By this point in 1623, the Bishop of Spalatro has managed to get out of England with a fair amount of the monetary wealth accumulated during his stay. He immediately writes pamphlets attacking his former confession, saying he was lying about his conversion and was actually for Rome all the time. A lot of people don't believe him, including the Inquisition.
And finally we reach 1624, with plays new and some revived. On Tuesday, the 6th of January, 1624, Middleton's play More Dissemblers Besides Women is revived for performance at court. Sir Henry Herbert, the recently appointed Master of the Revels, had relicensed the play for performance the previous year, though he thought that More Dissemblers Besides Women was
the worst play that e'er I saw.
The performance at court was a substitute for another entertainment, a Ben Jonson mask, Neptune's Triumph. This mask was supposed to be a celebration of the highlight of the political theatre of 1623, the return of Prince Charles and the Duke of Buckingham from Spain, and the unravelling of the Spanish match.
But someone obviously thought that obliquely referencing recent events in a public forum might not be a good idea. Hence the revived performance of More Dissemblers Besides Women.
The worst play that e'er I saw.
Coincidentally, on the 12th of June, 1624, these words were noted by Sir Henry Herbert.
A new play called A Game at Chess, written by Middleton.
Sir Henry was authorising the licence for a new play to be performed by the King's men.
Why the hell he did this is an open question. Because
a new play called A Game at Chess, written by Middleton,
would cause rather a lot of bother when, on the 5th of August, A Game at Chess premiered at the Globe Theatre on Bankside, presented by the King's Men with William Rowley crowbarred into the narrative as the Fat Bishop.
After a play's first performance, it was customary to rest it for a couple of weeks, while other different plays were performed daily until it was time for chess to come round again.
Except, no. The daily repertory system is bypassed the day after
A Game at Chess
is performed. The King's Men perform
A Game at Chess.
And then the next day they perform
A Game at Chess.
And after a few days of this, word gets out that this isn't a normal play. On Friday the 6th of August, the second day of the run of
A Game at Chess,
one John Woolley writes a letter to William Trumbull.
All the news I've heard since my coming to town is of a new play acted by His Majesty's servants. It is called A Game at Chess, but it may be a vox populi, for by report it is six times worse against the Spaniard. In it, Gondomar's devilish plots and devices are displayed, and many other things too long to recite. The conclusion expresseth His Highness's return and a mastery over the King of Spain.
The following day, Saturday 7th of August, the third day of the run, one George Lowe writes to Sir Arthur Ingram.
There is a new play called The Game at Chess, acted yesterday and today, which describes Gondomar and all the Spanish proceedings very boldly and broadly, so that it is thought that they will be called in and the parties punished.
And yes, word reaches the Spanish ambassador, who is very cross. He also writes a letter on the 7th of August to King James, telling him that 3,000 people are crowding in to watch the play, and that's when the house is a bit quiet. The audiences are lapping up a filthy comedy full of naughty words, and he cannot even bear to repeat them in the letter. And everyone in town knows how cross the ambassador is. On Wednesday, the 11th of August, the sixth performance of the run, John Woolley writes,
"The play of Gondomar is not yet suppressed, but it is feared it will be ere long, for the Spanish ambassador hath sent post after post with letters to complain to the king of it, and takes it very heinously that such a thing should be played against his master. But the players loseth no time, nor forbeareth to make hay while the sun shineth, acting it every day without any intermission. And it is thought they've already got near £1,000 by it."
Yes, everyone thinks shows actually make money. Also on the Wednesday, John Hollis writes,
"When I returned from your lordship hither upon Monday, I was saluted with a report of a facetious comedy, already thrice acted with extraordinary applause, a representation of all our Spanish traffic. I was invited by the reporter, Sir Edward George, to be also an auditor thereof, and accordingly yesterday to the Globe I rode, which house I found so thronged that by scores they came away for want of place. Though as yet little past one."
The house is full an hour before show begins. All this noise has finally reached the ear of the king, who is in the Midlands. On Thursday, 12th of August, the seventh show of the run, Sir Edward Conway, Secretary of State, reports to the Privy Council thus.
"His Majesty hath received information from the Spanish ambassador of a very scandalous comedy acted publicly by the king's players. His Majesty remembers well there was a commandment and restraint given against the representing of any modern Christian kings in those stage plays, and wonders much, both at the boldness now taken by that company, and also that it has been permitted to be so acted, and that the first notice thereof should be brought to him by a foreign ambassador, while so many ministers of his own are thereabouts and cannot but have heard of it.
And in a concerted effort to pour oil on troubled waters, about the same time Sir Edward writes to Don Carlos, the upset Spanish ambassador.
I have shown Your Excellency's letter to His Majesty, who is much astonished at the great insolence and boldness which, as Your Excellency states, the actors have committed, and which His Majesty so much regrets that Your Excellency may rest assured that justice will be done in this matter with the proper publicity.
But, as of yet, it's still being performed. It's Friday the 13th, the day of the 8th performance, and one Paul Overton writes...
At the Globe Playhouse is daily presented an odious play against Spain, but principally Gondomar and the Jesuits.
Meanwhile, even the Florentine ambassador is in on it. He writes that the play leaves nothing out of what Gondomar was like, and the audience apparently laps it up. The ambassador claims the theatre is taking 300 gold scudos a pop. Make your mind up what the daily take is, please. Saturday, 14th of August, the final day, Sir Francis Nethersole writes to Sir Dudley Carlton.
Yet we have now these 10 days a new play here, the plot whereof is a game of chess, under which the whole Spanish business is ripped up to the quick and Gondomar brought onto the stage in his chair, which fitteth scorners so well that the players have gotten £100 the day ever since. For they play no thing else, knowing their time cannot be long.
Their time cannot be long. And with that thought, we will now prepare to show you this scandal, this terrible filth, this knife-sharp satire. A Game at Chess by Thomas Middleton. Thank you very much.
And that performance of A Game at Chess will follow later in the year, along with the rest of Middleton's Endgame. But if you just can't wait, rough cuts for the whole day, and the materials we use to make it are available as a box set on our Patreon for a one-off fee, link in the show description. And then there is a host of other material on the podcast and YouTube channel, so many readings of the play in different cuts, depending on your interest, all available for free. There's also a discussion on Middleton's legacy on the pod with the editors of a collection on that subject. Supporting us on any level on the Patreon is a huge help, so it would be lovely to see you there. There's even a free subscription tier to keep up to speed with developments. Alternatively, you can support us on ko-fi.com/beyondshakespeare, and links to all these are in the show description. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.